Lecture 23, Zen.
In our last lecture, we talked about Honen, Shinran, and Nichiren, and the Buddhism of the Kamakura period. We talked about some of the distinctive historical features of that time, that period in Japanese history. Before we move on to the last topic in our discussion of Japanese Buddhism, I think we ought to pause for a moment and consider how far we have come. And it's really quite a distance from the serene, solitary figure of Siddhartha Gautama to the fiery devotion of Shinran and to the passionate political statements of Nichiren. I hope you're asking yourselves, after the last lecture, and you ask yourselves, right now, do you think that the Buddhism of Honen, Shinran, and Nichiren has changed so much from the tradition that we once studied when we contemplated the life story of that serene Indian stage? Has it changed so much that it is no longer recognizable as Buddhism? Is this Buddhism anymore that we're talking about now, or has the tradition evolved into something that we really can't connect to that figure, Siddhartha Gautama? Some people would say that it has. Some Buddhists would say that it has. Others would say that beneath the differences in doctrine and the differences in tone lie some of the fundamental convictions of the Buddhist tradition that are simply working themselves out in a new idiom. I must say I'd put myself in that category. I see the devotion of Honen, Shinran, and Nichiren as a continuation, a continuous struggle, you might say, with that impulse toward liberation that was set in motion initially by the figure of the historical Buddha. But either way, these new traditions challenge us to think again about the significance of the Buddha's teaching and about some of its possible implications. They also prepare us to think in new ways about the historical and religious significance of a tradition that's familiar, I think, to most of us, the tradition of Zen in Japan. Like these other movements from the Kamakura period, Zen was a product of very specific historical circumstances in Kamakura during a period of great military difficulty. Now, the Zen tradition, as we know it, traces its roots to the Chan tradition in China, and through Chan to the meditative traditions of India. As I said, when we were talking about Chan in the lecture on Chinese Buddhism, the word Zen is sometimes said to be a Japanese mispronunciation of a Chinese mispronunciation of an Indian word that means something like meditation, and this is true. The Indian word actually is jhana, a word that can be translated as concentration, or sometimes appears in the translation of Indian texts as trance. Jhana, or dhyana in Sanskrit, corresponds to the mental concentration, or the samadhi, that plays such a crucial role in the traditional Indian path to nirvana. Now, to begin thinking about Zen, or to begin experiencing it, because Zen is an experiential tradition, you could start with the most basic form of Indian mental concentration. You could just sit still on a cushion or in a chair, fold your hands gently in your lap, and concentrate on your breath. Just count your breath. Count to 10, and when you get to 10, start again with 1. And as you breathe, allow your thoughts to dissipate and let the mind become calm. That's the foundation of Zen, and it's the foundation of Buddhist tradition or Buddhist meditation more generally. The goal of this process, of course, is to prepare for awakening in a very specific Mahayana sense, that is, to achieve an awareness of emptiness. Zen stresses that this awareness can't be achieved conceptually, and it can't be expressed in words. You've got to get it directly in experience. It has to be achieved with your whole being. And you can't just sit down and get it for yourself. It has to be transmitted to you from teacher as if it were transmitted from a teacher to a student through a process of direct experiential encounter. Now, Zen, as a historical movement in Japan, took shape as a separate sect in the Kamakura period under the influence of two forceful personalities. The first of these is Eisai. Like many of the Kamakura reformers, Eisai, who lived from 1141 to 1215, began his training in the Tendai school on Mount Hiei in Kyoto. After becoming disenchanted with Tendai practice, he traveled to China to learn the traditional discipline of meditation. In China, he studied Chan, and he returned to Japan in 1191 as a full-fledged master of what's called in Japanese the Rinzai school of Zen. A Rinzai is best known, especially these days, for a practice known as koan practice. It's used to achieve an experience of sudden awakening. A koan is a riddle that's used especially in an encounter between a master and a student to stop the mind in its tracks and precipitate some kind of breakthrough into a direct experiential awareness of emptiness. Typical koans are often talked about and are quite familiar to many of us. One is the question, does a dog have Buddha nature? Another, what's the sound of one hand clapping? And some old manuals, you can actually look these questions up and you can find standard answers to them. But of course, the standard answer has to be something that you discover for yourself. In my courses on Buddhism at BU, we often look at a little sequence of video of an encounter between a student and a master in one of the training monasteries in Japan, where the master asks the student the koan, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the student situates himself firmly on his cushion and gives some version of the standard answer, which is the Japanese word for nothingness or emptiness. And it sounds a little bit like this. Moo! And the master clears his throat and he says to the student, put your attention in the pit of your stomach and speak from emptiness with your whole being. And then he rings his little bell and the student gets up and leaves the room. Now, whether he got it right when he said moo is another question, and something I suppose that we can only understand for ourselves when we encounter a Zen master face to face. You can get a sense of what that encounter feels like. It's a way of taking a question and forcing you to understand something experientially that breaks through your ordinary conceptual awareness of things. The use of koans to precipitate this kind of change is distinctive to the Rinzai tradition. Now, Eisai found that Kyoto was hostile to his new teaching. It was sectarian in its own way, like the teaching of Honen and Shinran and Nichiren. So he moved to the new center of political power in Kamakura and began to preach Zen to the military warlords in Kamakura. His stress on sturdy self-reliance and on fearlessness in the face of death won him many disciples among the military classes in Japan, and it made Zen an important component in the martial arts from that day to this. So Eisai was one of the first to make that direct connection between the practice of Zen meditation and the military discipline that was necessary to thrive in the Kamakura period. The second important personality in the formation of Zen in this time was a man named Dogen, who lived from 1200 to 1253. He also began his career on Mount Hiei, and he followed Eisai's footsteps to China. When Dogen returned from China, he established a tradition that is known as the Soto School of Zen. Dogen thought that koan practice, as Eisai practiced it, put too much stress on achieving awakening as if it were different from ordinary experience. And you can imagine how he might have felt about this if Asai had his students going in and struggling with these koans to get some sudden awareness that was completely transformative and different from their ordinary experience. That was, of course, significant matter, a significant discipline, but it also held up the Enlightenment experience as being something very different from ordinary experience. And that, too, was a kind of dualistic thinking that you might criticize and you might want to abandon in your practice of Zen. Dogen took this position. And he insisted instead that the central practice in Zen should be zazen, or simply sitting meditation, as an end in itself. Just to sit. Dogen also criticized the idea of a degenerate age, arguing that all moments and points in space are equally reflective of emptiness. And you can imagine why he would take this position as well. It makes sense if he's working through the implications of that old Mahayana concept of emptiness. A classic expression of his approach to emptiness is found in his statement called Being Time. Know that in this way, he says, there are myriads of forms and hundreds of grasses throughout the entire earth, and yet each grass and each form itself is the entire earth. The study of this is the beginning of practice. When you are at this place, there is just one grass, and there is just one form. There is understanding of form, and there is no understanding of form. Kind of thing that Nagarjuna would say. There is understanding of grass, and there is no understanding of grass. Since there is nothing but just this moment, the being time is all the time there is. Grass being, form being, are both time. Each moment is all being, the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. What a strong and traditional Mahayana critique of this Kamakura notion of the degenerate age. Sure, we're living in tough times. You know, times may always be tough for somebody, but what is it that really distinguishes this moment from any other moment when it's viewed from the point of view of emptiness? Nothing. If you want to be awakened, you have to perceive all of reality in this moment the same way you would perceive it at any other time or in any other place. Now, you can see here, obviously, I think that the echoes of this teaching should be very strong in your ears. This is the Tiantai teaching of Jue, the idea of the thousand worlds present in an instant of thought. And it also is that old Huayan doctrine of Indra's net, the image of the net made up of a multitude of jewels, where each individual jewel in the net reflects all other jewels in the net. Dogen is saying each blade of grass, each moment of time is the totality of reality. If you can become present to that moment, you will see all of the cosmos and you'll become awakened. It's a strong Mahayana teaching. One of Dogen's most powerful statements about Zen is the Genjo Koan, or a text that's known in English as Actualizing the Fundamental Point. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drops away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the entire sky are reflected in dewdrops on the grass, or even in one drop of water. Same concept, expressed in a kind of Zen philosophical poetry. Perceive one drop of dew, and you see a reflection of the entire cosmos. Now, Aesai and Dogen were the founders of course, quite specific lineages in the Zen tradition in Japan, and they continue today. It's possible to go and visit many monasteries in Japan that practice quite faithfully these traditions. Kyoto has several major Rinzai monastic centers, and Dogen's monastery is still an active place and one that is well worth visiting. But they also helped infuse Japanese culture with a spirit of Zen, even for a lot of people who were not involved in their movements in a sectarian sense. I've already mentioned the martial arts, of course. I have an old student friend who worked with me when I was at Harvard Divinity School who always used to joke with me that if we wanted to try to find Buddhism in America, one of the best places to go would be simply to make a pilgrimage through the martial arts academies, not just of the major cities, but all of the small towns and hamlets throughout America where teenagers and young people were practicing the martial arts. It's really through the martial arts that many people come to know this tradition for the first time and then find their way into the practice of Zen in a more complex and technical sense. But Zen also is found in other aspects of Japanese culture. When I was in Japan just recently, my wife and I spent quite a bit of time in Kyoto studying the tradition of Zen gardens. Many of these gardens, I think, are known somewhat mistakenly, actually, in a technical sense, as being Zen gardens. They often show images not simply of a, shall we say, a Zen contemplative space, but images of a pure land that might be associated with the pure land tradition of Honen or Shinran or some other mapping of the cosmos in a Buddhist way. But where they're most powerful is when they where they express the empty space that's the focus of Zen meditation. One of the most famous of these is the garden at Ryoanji, a well-known Buddhist temple in Kyoto that's often pictured in studies of the Japanese garden tradition. It's a large rectangular space filled with white sand, fine white gravel, and in that space are 15 rocks very carefully placed. And around the space is a wall made of stucco that has in the stucco a certain mixture of clay and oil so that the oil has bled out of the clay and looks like the background, the gold background of a Chinese painting. In fact, the garden in Ryoanji in some ways is a three-dimensional realization of one of those wonderful Chinese paintings of a landscape that shows mountains emerging from clouds, shows the mountain image as an image of the assertive and positive aspect of the movement of forces in the universe, and the clouds as the passive aspect of reality that we associate with the Taoist image of the interplay of opposites in a harmonious vision of the cosmos. Ryoanji is a little bit like that. It's got stones sticking up through the gravel as if they were mountaintops peeking up through the mist that covers the face of the earth. When I was there in Japan looking in this place, I talked to one of the monks and asked him how they use these gardens as contemplative devices in their practice of Zen. One would, of course, be curious about this. They're not really meant to represent the world, but to be tools for meditation in one way or another. And his answer surprised me. He said that the first thing that they do in a monastery, and they do this for many years, actually, is simply to learn how to clean the monastery, to sweep the floor and to polish it, and especially to sweep the garden and to rake it. So one of the most fundamental things that you do with a Japanese Zen garden is simply to maintain it in a certain kind of fastidiously prescribed way, so that each gesture that you perform, each move that you make with the rake, becomes a focal point of meditation. So your first encounter with this object is really through work, through the discipline of labor. But then he said that there also are moments in the flow of the day in a monastery when you're not doing carefully prescribed meditation, but simply have an opportunity to do zazen on your own in a different setting, and often at night, especially under the light of a moon, it's wonderful to sit down on the edge of one of these gardens and absorb yourself in a state of concentration, where the garden itself expresses to you some of the sense of quiet, simplicity, and stillness that is really the heart of Zen. I think for many of us, this visual representation of Zen is one of the most powerful. People don't always, of course, sit down and practice Zen, but they can relate to it in this visual way, and the extraordinary icon of the Zen experience of contemplation that's created by one of these landscape spaces. Another important example of the influence of Zen values on Japanese culture is in the tradition of Japanese poetry. And I've always found that one of the most eloquent and expressive representatives of this tradition is the poet Matsuo Basho, who lived from 1644 to 1694, one of the most famous and respected poets in the Japanese tradition. One of his poems, I believe, may very well be familiar to you. It's widely quoted when people talk about Japanese culture, and some people say that if you can understand what Basho's getting at in this poem, you can really put your heart on the put your finger on the heart of Japanese culture. The poem is pretty simple. Let me read it. Let me intone it. Old pond, frog jumps in, sound of water. Now, you know enough about Buddhism by now to begin to interpret this poem. The place you would go, I suspect, and I bet many of you are already there in your associations with aspects of the earlier tradition, is to the three levels of truth in Zhe'yi's Tiantai system in China. He said that there were three ways of looking at the world. One was from the point of view of emptiness, the other was from a conventional point of view, and the third was from the point of view of the truth of the mean, the combination of the ultimate and the conventional. The first line, old pond, represents the truth of emptiness. It's the still, quiet pond of the mind, that ancient pond that we touch in the heart of our meditation. What's the next moment in the process? Out of the grass at the side of the pond comes a frog, plop, right in the middle of the pond. That's a conventional event, something that happens in a moment and makes a sound. It also is a natural event. It's an animal. It's not somebody drawing something on the surface of the pond. It's simply a frog out of his own spontaneous nature going plop into the pond. And then what results from this? A sound of water, simply a moment of perception. It's the combination of the ultimate and the conventional. The implication of this verse is that if you can perceive that sound of water, if you can become present to that single moment of perception, then you can grasp in it, in that, like the drop of dew on the blade of grass, the totality of experience. So it's a thousand worlds in an instant of thought, a thousand worlds in an instant of experience. Now, in this poem, it's nice to read it as a mapping of Zhe'yi. I suppose you can see a pretty good way that Zhe'yi's philosophy comes down to earth in a pretty effective way. But where the poem really comes alive for me, I must say, is when I think of Basho himself as being like the frog. Because we're looking at reality mapped on the page, sure. Mapped through the sound of my voice, perhaps. But it's still something out there that's distant from us. But Basho is like a Zen master. He's not in a technical sense, but he's functioning like a Zen master for us. And what he's trying to do is to put into the still pond of our consciousness a sound that will crystallize some experience of awakening. So think of Basho like a frog. We are an old pond. Into the stillness of that pond plops this frog. This guy Basho, making some sort of a sound. And the moment of perception that's generated by this is the moment of awakening that Basho is trying to seek. Now, you get this same kind of intensity in other verses of Basho. I won't comment on them as extensively as I've commented on this, but I'd like to read you a couple of more because they really express in a beautiful way Basho's own vision of the Zen tradition. He wrote a book called The Narrow Road to the Deep North about his travel experiences on a long pilgrimage journey up into the northern part of Japan. Talked a little bit about some of the experiences that he had along the way, and then he often distilled these experiences into these short three-line verses. Here's one that expresses, again, in a very explicit and powerful way, the threefold vision of the Tiantai. In the silence of an old temple, a cicada's voice splits the rock. Pretty clear. The temple, it's quiet, it's silent, it's timeless in a sense. And then there's this bzzzt sound of a cicada that splits, that slices through the air and splits the rock. What would be the rock? Rock of the landscape, I suppose, but also something in the heart of the poet. And in the heart of the listener. Often Basho's poems have a certain kind of emotional tone that's important in Japanese literature as well. A tone of sadness, a tone of melancholy. You can feel that in another of his famous poems, From the Narrow Road to the Deep North. I'm awestruck, he says, to hear a cricket singing in the cavity of an old helmet. Here he's gone to a battlefield where old, long-dead warriors are memorialized simply by the preservation of their helmet. In the cavity of this helmet, like the dome of emptiness, sings a cricket, and he is struck with awe. So you can see here how Basho works with the Zen aesthetic in a poetic way. Now, it's occurred to me as we talk about Zen that all of this is in the past. It's a tradition that we observe historically in Japan. But one always wonders, what would it be like if it's brought into the classroom? What would it be like if we brought Zen into our experience right now? I've often thought about that when I speak historically about this tradition to students at Boston University. How does the experience of Zen somehow touch down in a student's life? We don't practice Zen together. That wouldn't be considered, I suppose, appropriate in an academic setting of a classroom. But one student once gave me a story that I must say spoke as vividly to me about Zen experience in a student's life as anything that I've ever heard in the Zen tradition. It's not a technical story, and it wouldn't necessarily pass muster amongst the serious historians of Zen, but it gets me in the heart. And I want to finish my discussion of Zen by telling it to you. I was talking about Zen as I was just speaking now one day, and a student came up to me and he said, "Professor, I think I know something about Zen. I think I know something about this." And I said, "Yeah? Tell me more." He said, "Well, I was once studying at a military academy in New Mexico, and there was a sergeant who was supposed to be a Zen teacher. And I went to him and I said, 'Sergeant, teach me about Zen.' And he looked me up and down and he said, 'Well, I'll teach you about Zen, but I want you to answer a question for me first. Come on over to the window.' So he took me over to the window and he pointed to three trees and he said, 'See those trees? What does the middle tree mean?' And I looked at the trees and I said, well, you know, it's kind of like an architectural barrier and it separates the soccer field from the river. And the sergeant said, get out of here. Don't come back until you can tell me what it means. And he came back a week later and he said, well, Sergeant, you know, I've been thinking about this. And he said, I think it's kind of like a symbol of organic creativity, you know. It puts its roots down in the soil and it gets water and it's got its leaves up in the air. Sergeant said, get out of here. Don't come back until you can tell me what it means. So he thought about it for a while and he became obsessed by this tree. One day he was sitting in chapel right next to the tree and he just became so frustrated that he couldn't deal with it anymore. And he jumped up in the middle of the chapel service and he went running out and he looked at the tree and he said, that tree doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean a damn thing. And he went back to the sergeant and he said, Sergeant, that tree doesn't mean anything. And the sergeant said, okay, now I can teach you about Zen. Powerful tradition, direct experience of emptiness, a direct experience of ultimate reality.